Good morning. This is Larry Warren along with my co-host Doug Wells, and it's Monday morning, so it's Mountain Money on a beautiful sunny day after, Doug, a weekend finally of snow.
We got a little bit of everything this weekend.
Well, yeah.
Saturday was actually pretty nice early in the day, and then we got a lot of snow Sunday and also a lot of wind.
And I heard lots of avalanche control work booming away this morning, so that indicates up high there's a good deposit. So that's terrific news in a ski town, and here we are at Sundance, what, -4, +4? Sundance coming
Thursday. Looking at the construction workers scurrying away at this temporary building on Sweet Alley.
The flying saucer in Sweet Alley.
People are working hard. It's going to be a good 2 weeks.
And, you know, there's usually a huge snowstorm in the middle of Sundance, but it's not going to happen the first couple of days because it looks like we have sunny skies forecast all through this week. Well, we'll get to that later. Right now, let's talk about our lineup for Mountain Money. And first, we're going to talk with Paul Oyer, and this has to be the best book title of the year.
I agree.
Of course, we're only 2 weeks into the year, but I think this will hold up for another 50 weeks. Paul is an economist, works at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, and his book is Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. So, and it's a really entertaining read, and you learn a lot about economics,
yeah,
and about online dating, actually.
You know, I say often people are complex, and it's hard to kind of figure out what people are going to do. Sometimes even more complex than people are businesses, trying to figure out what businesses are going to do. And the rules of economics give you kind of a framework to think about these things. But the challenge is it's hard for the average person to kind of really understand some of these theories. And Paul's reviews on Amazon talk about how bringing this into the online dating world really makes it approachable. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. Our second guest, Larry, is going to be Chris Monroe. Everybody here probably remembers the gingerbread house on the Deer Valley traffic circle. Chris bought the gingerbread house and has spent a lot of time and effort remodeling it and refurbishing it, and it's now the Torchlight Inn, and I guess it's up and operational. We're going to have Chris in studio to talk about the Torchlight Inn. And then our final guest is going to be Peter Metcalf, who most of us know as the CEO of Black Diamond. Larry, we had Peter on about a year ago. Great conversation about his company and some of his stances on the environment. And today we're going to talk to him about something entirely differently.
Got a new feather in his cap.
Yeah, just at the start of this year, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System named him a director of the Salt Lake City branch of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, which is quite an assignment, and I'm interested to find out more what's involved in that. It's going to be an interesting conversation. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned.
This is Christian Bohr with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Chamber Bureau members enjoy a wide array of benefits, including instant credibility, weekly newsletters with relevant information, educational seminars, webinars, and much more. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Underwriting on KPCW is supported by Mountain West Bank in Park City, a community bank offering home financing service and guidance. Mountain West Bank is located near Kearns Boulevard next to the movie theater. More information at mountainwestbank.com. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And welcome back to Mountain Money in sunny Park City this morning. We have on the line with us now Paul Oyer, and Paul is a professor of economics at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business. Before that, he was at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, and he's editor-in-chief of the Journal of Labor Economics, which, you know, as a non-economist, I would think would be pretty dry, but his other bit of writing recently is the book from Harvard Business Review Press called Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. Welcome, Paul, to Mountain Money.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is a curious book, and it's at times hilarious and at times very educational about how the economy works. And how did you come up with the idea of telling the story of economics kind of for the layman by relating it to online dating?
Well, I'm an economist, and I'm very enamored of economics, and I always want to share that with people. I always want people to see how economics is affecting their everyday life, and I think understanding that helps people make better decisions and so forth. But it's hard to sort of convey the general ideas in economics without getting into the dry parts. You know, you mentioned the journal I edit, which is somewhat dry, I will admit. So,
well, economics kind of has the nickname of the dismal science, doesn't it?
It does. It does, and it can be dry and dismal. So when I went into online dating a few years ago, I was sort of returning to the dating market, and it just hit me that word I just used, market. It really plays out. A lot of what I think is interesting about microeconomics plays out in the online dating market. And the reason I particularly liked, so first of all, it's good, you know, for the reasons you said, it's something people find interesting. And so to be able to explain economics there is hopefully makes it more palatable. But the other thing that I really like about this using online dating is people tend to associate economics with money. And so they think, oh, just about maximizing your income or something like that. Everything is about money. But economists, we're very uninterested in money. We think money's there to sort of make transactions easier and so forth, but it's a very minor and uninteresting part of at least microeconomics. And so what I really like about online dating is it's a nice way to explain economics without in a market where there's no money changing hands. And so many of the things that we see play out in the job market and other markets plays out in the online dating market.
You know, Paul, I work with a lot of folks that have been successful in their own fields, but maybe haven't spent a lot of time in finance and economics. And when I talk to those folks, they really think of economics more of forecasting. And, mm-hmm. and like you, when I went to business school, there were two subjects that I really enjoyed, really opened my eyes, and I really enjoyed a lot. One was economics and the other was strategy. And the thing about economics was it really wasn't about forecasting. It was really about understanding why things take place and what are the main factors that drive those. And talk to us about, which to me was just exciting. It opened my eyes. So talk to us about a couple of those main concepts that you talk about in your book and how online dating gives you a format to explain what could be a complex topic in a very simple to understand way.
Right. So yeah, I that's a great way of thinking about it. Maybe the most fundamental idea in economics is cost benefit analysis. And we're sort of going through our day constantly trying to make ourselves better off and happier. And so when we make little decisions, we never stop to say this, but we're implicitly saying to ourselves, are the benefits of what I'm about to do going to outweigh the costs? And so, you know, you go to the store and you say, should I buy this, you know, cereal? Well, is it worth $5 or whatever? So those types of transactions happen all the time. Well, there's a model, a very important model in economics, class of models called search theory. And this is a very important point in our everyday lives because we're constantly going around saying, should I buy that cereal or should I go to another store where I think it might be cheaper, but it might not be. And so then, so you're constantly deciding, do I want to expend a little more effort searching for something better, cheaper, or whatever, or should I settle for what I have now? Well, when it comes to prices and cereal, there's money involved, but the exact same economic phenomenon is playing out on an online dating site. So if I get on an online dating site and I'm looking at over the potential choices, I'm constantly saying to myself, you know, should I keep looking? If I look at 10 more profiles, there's some chance that somebody really great is going to come up. When you think of it in those terms, you say, wow, I really have to because, you know, we've all been trained to think I have to keep looking until the one is out there. But in fact, there are costs to doing that. And so when you're on an online dating site, at some point you give up and you say, okay, I'm going to go, you know, send a message to this person and this person, and then I'm going to give up because I have to go do the dishes now.
In fact, you said to your current friend, girlfriend, that I hope she doesn't remember what I wrote in the first chapter about search theory.
It's true. The first chapter about search theory is, I think, quite realistic, but not the most romantic view of things, because it starts from the premise that you really can't find the one. And if you keep searching for the one, the perfect person, you're going to be frustrated.
Yeah, I can see how that could get you in trouble right away.
Well, in fact, you talk about adverse selection, and one of the things, while most of us can't spend all of our time searching, there is a subset of people that, you know, don't have much better to do in their life, and
right.
They continue to search, and so there is this adverse selection, which is an economics term, involved in the online dating pool.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody's been sitting, if somebody is on a dating site for years on end, for example, that's a warning, right?
That's person a signaling
is not,
effect.
That's a yes. It has a very negative signal, and so, and by the way, you know, this is something that plays out in a different market that's very relevant. If you're an unemployed person, the longer you're unemployed, the worse it gets, the harder it gets to find a job, and that's, you know, again, very much an adverse selection thing where firms see somebody who's out of work for a long time, and the longer they're out of work, make assumptions about why that is.
How about the idea of thick versus thin markets, which is kind of this concept that maybe doesn't – a lot of people think doesn't apply to them, but it really does in more ways than one.
Yeah, I mean, thick. You want to be in thick markets if you're going out to buy something or generally to do transactions. Thick markets are very good. And what we mean by thick markets are markets where there are a lot of buyers and sellers. And so in the stock market, that's sort of an obvious point. You want more buyers and sellers of stock. If you're buying stock, you want a lot more people out there selling it because that's going to lead to more competition, and that's good for you. Now, in the online dating market, thick markets are very different. It's not so much that you need more competition from the other side. It's that unlike stocks and bonds, where at least within a given stock, each one is the same, in the dating market, each potential partner is different. So this is at the risk of being really ridiculously economics-ese on you. We can think of potential partners as a differentiated good. So they're like jobs or houses. No two are the same. And so why do we want a thick market? Not so much because of the competition effect, but more because the more people out there that I have to choose from as potential partners, and of course that are in turn choosing me, the more likely I'm going to find somebody who's a good match for me. And so thick markets lead to better matches as well as even beyond the fact that there's more competition.
Now
they just lead to better matches.
You're a researcher, right? Is there really data that shows that? Because, Paul, I think you and I are probably – I read your reviews. I read a little bit about your background on Amazon. I think you and I are about the same age. And when we were dating, first coming out of college, not you and I dating, but in our dating experiences,
we get it.
it was a very different world, right? It was essentially you have this pool of, you know, at most 500 people that are in your social circle, and those were the folks that you started dating, and everybody was kind of in the same stage. We're all, you know, okay, college is done. We're thinking about life going forward, and we're thinking about, you know, who we want as our partner. The pool was much smaller, but yet as I look at the happiness of me and my friends versus the folks that are coming out now that maybe had the thicker market, are uh-huh. there studies that show that those relationships are stronger?
That's a really good question. I haven't seen anything yet on that, and somebody should take that up.
My guess is no, but it's just a guess. My guess is that the outcome's going to be about the same.
Well, you know, there's so many societal changes in the interim that we'd have to control for. So as a researcher, you'd have to think very carefully about how could I make that comparison in a way that took account of all those sorts of things. But I agree. That's a I would hope that as the ability to sort of intermingle and go outside of the, you know, 100 people who live in the town who are your age has gotten greater over time, that should lead to better matches. I mean, presumably, there is some evidence that thicker markets lead to better matches in the job market. Okay, so there are academic studies that show that pretty convincingly. So to give you an example, if you're an engineer in Kansas City, Missouri, for example, there are a lot of great engineering jobs there. But if you're an engineer in San Jose, California, there are just, you know, X times as many great jobs. And if you look in the evidence, the people who are engineers in San Jose end up switching jobs a lot more early in their careers, but then settling into happier long-term relationships with their job, if you will, because the market is thicker and they find a better match.
Well, Paul, let's go back to the basics and when you started this this quest. Why did you start? Was it you didn't have time and didn't want to go to the bars, or did you approach it as an economist and say maybe a computer sort is a better way to go when you re-injected yourself in the dating scene?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was so lucky that the internet had come along and created online dating. So we can think of a bunch of economic reasons why I used online dating, one of which is just simply what you would say is my preferences. I always hated going to bars and looking for women and that sort of thing. I'm sort of antisocial, so it was easier for me to start with emails and messages and to know people that way and learn some stuff about them from their profile. I just found that much, much more to my taste. And then on top of that, I think it's just such an efficient use of time to sort of scan through people's profiles and so forth online. It's a place where I think the internet has made, I hate to use the term shopping, but sort of picking.
Well, it does sort of turn it into a scientific, a data-driven process rather than romance.
It does. And then, you know, beyond in the background, of course, there are all these computer algorithms that are telling me you should look at this person or you should look at that person. And so that really takes the economists' analysis of this takes some of the romance out of it, and then the computer scientists take the rest out.
Indeed. And then you have to worry, don't you? Or maybe it's changed over time, but people not exactly leveling on their online profiles and such.
Oh, no, that has. I don't know why that hasn't changed. There's a great deal of lying on the on online profiles. We call this, as economists, we refer to this as cheap talk models. So people will say things, and unless they have, you know, they're always driven by incentives, and if they can shade the truth a little bit. Now, there are some people who are just, you know, very honest and forthcoming no matter what, and that's great, but you have to acknowledge the fact and understand the fact that not everybody is that way. And so there's a lot of evidence, again, some academic studies, but also just some personal anecdotal information. I can assure you there are a lot of people who don't tell exactly the truth.
Now, I'm reading a summary here from Harvard Business Review Press that I got to tell you, I never thought I'd see coming across the pages of Harvard Business Review Press, which is the top 10 dating tips from an economist. Larry, who was our guest last week we had on from the Harvard Business Review blog?
Kathleen.
Her first name's Kathleen.
But, put me on the spot.
Sorry.
This is 2 weeks in a row we've had someone representing the Harvard Business Review Press.
Yeah, so as I told Kathleen last week, I'm a big fan of the blog that the Harvard Business Review puts on. And I'm just chuckling that Harvard Business Review Press and top 10 dating tips. But some of these are pretty good. Give us some of your favorites that made the top 10 list of dating tips from an economist.
See, I'll have to pull them. I don't have them handy. I can pull them up.
I'll do my best David Letterman. we'll start.
I don't think it's Well, they're not that good. We have to warn your audience. They're not as funny as David Letterman Top 10.
Yeah, I set the bar a little too high. We'll just do two or three of them. And you know, let's see. Don't get married until you think through what will happen if you ever break up. That sounds like good advice that my parents
gave me. That would be the law of unintended consequences.
There you go. There you go. People are drawn to and happiest with people like themselves, unlike the cliche that says opposites attract and similarities repel. Your study has shown that just the opposite. People are drawn to people like themselves.
Well, it's not so much my study. The literature on the economics of marriage and both by sociologists and by economists is pretty clear. People marry their own type. You see very little, you know, the example I give in the book is, what was that movie with Richard Gere and Julia Roberts?
Pretty Woman?
Pretty Woman.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a good movie, but it's just not the way the world works.
You know, and then we're all, you know, all of us are different. I noticed in your book, one of the criteria that was really high on your list, and I had to chuckle because it's kind of high on my list as well. You were looking for a life partner that would laugh at your jokes. And if your jokes are like mine, it extended the search a little bit.
Yeah, that was definitely one of my challenges.
Yeah, telling economics jokes will only get you so far.
That's right.
Yeah, I usually don't tell economics jokes.
You have a couple other on the top 10, which I think for folks that are looking at online dating for the first time are kind of important, which is to remember that most people on the online dating site exaggerate.
And probably as
people are putting their profile on, it's okay to exaggerate a little bit, because if you don't, you're going to be at a disadvantage on that site.
I hate to encourage people to lie or exaggerate, but you do have to keep in mind that your competition is not always completely upfront and forthright. That's right.
So, and is that how you look at it? You're a I don't know, 40, 50-ish male.
50.
You're in a competitive market and you have to market yourself because you're just a commodity on the website.
Well, you're not a commodity, and so that's an important point. That you know, as I mentioned before, unlike stocks and bonds, you're not a commodity in the sense that everybody's the same. But you are in competition in the way you just suggested. Now, the good thing I might add is, like a lot of other markets, supply and demand forces have a big effect on this. And you mentioned I'm a 50-ish man. That actually is sort of a good thing. At my age and certainly above, the demographics start tilting in favor of the men.
Supply and demand.
So, exactly. And so the supply of men starts to fall off at about my age, and that's good news for men. And also that differs a lot by cities. So I live in the Bay Area, which, because of its engineering focus and for various other reasons that I'm not entirely clear about, there are relatively more men. So for young single women, the Bay Area is a very good place, whereas New York and Washington have a oversupply of young eligible women.
So, Paul, we've only got time for a couple more questions, but I want you to bring the audience full circle if you can. So you found yourself looking for a life partner. You went online where there's hundreds of thousands of potential matches. And how did you end up finding your current life partner, your current girlfriend?
Well, I tried a few different websites to keep my options open. What's very interesting about my current girlfriend and our relationship is the fact that we did find each other online, because that's where the market is thick for people in their 40s looking for partners. You know, if you're a college student, there's really no need to go online. You've got eligible potential partners all around you. But I went online, and what turned out to be very interesting in our case is we met each other online, and it turned out we only work 100 yards apart, and we have a lot of friends in common, but we had never met each other before.
Isn't that funny?
So if we'd sort of kept at it, maybe someday we would have found each other, but it would have taken a longer time. And by going to where the market was thick online, we found each other much more quickly. And you know, we've been together for a year and a half now, and things are going very well. So I'm quite pleased with the decision to sort of go searching online, because for me, that turned out to be
helped you find the woman that was 100 yards down from your office.
Exactly.
Well, we love to end with happy endings, and that's one. Paul, thanks for joining us this morning. Our guest has been Paul Oyer. His book is published by Harvard Business Review Press, although he is a Stanford faculty member in the Graduate School of Business. The book, and I still think, Paul, I don't know if you heard the introduction, I said I think this is the best book title of the year, and I think it'll hold up for another 50 weeks. Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. And that is the book, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a great time.
Thank you, Paul. The book got great reviews on Amazon. I didn't get to read it in its entirety, but I do plan on reading it later this week or next week. Thanks again, Paul.
Thank you.
All right. Our next guest is going to be in studio with us. It's Chris Monroe. He is the owner of the Torchlight Bed and Breakfast. He's going to be in studio with us in a few minutes. And we, oh, she, sorry. Chris is female. Sorry about that, Chris. But we'll be back and talk about Mountain Money and talk with Chris about the new bed and breakfast in a moment. Stay tuned.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Just because it's white outside doesn't mean you can't stay green.
Listen to This Green Earth every Tuesday at 9 a.m.
Discussing environmental issues from methane gas to moose habitat.
Air quality to fire ecology.
And bark beetles to eating bugs.
That's This Green Earth, brought to you by Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Republic Services.
Habitat for Humanity's Restore.
And Rocky Mountain Power.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. It was a fun conversation with Paul Oyer, author of Everything I Ever Wanted to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. And Larry, I learned a couple things about economics this morning, and I also learned a couple things about online
dating.
Well,
does that mean your wife needs to be nervous about
hopefully
your
I never have to
habits.
Go there. Hopefully I never have, nor hopefully my wife it never has to go there. But in studio now is Chris Monroe. I mentioned in the opening, most of us remember the gingerbread house, what my kids used to call on the Deer Valley traffic circle. It is no longer the gingerbread house. It's gotten an upgrade and a facelift, and Chris Monroe is in studio with us now. She's the owner of Torchlight. Welcome to Mountain Money, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. It's good to have you here. And I understand Torchlight Bed and Breakfast is now up and running. When did you guys open, and kind of what's the theme behind the bed and breakfast there?
Okay. Well, yes, we officially opened December 1st after 16 months of vigorous renovations, as you've probably noticed going through the roundabout. We are a full-service bed and breakfast. We have six rooms. All six of our rooms are nicely decorated, sort of minimalist decorated. They all have fireplaces and decks. We also have a rooftop deck with a fireplace as well.
There must be a hot tub somewhere too.
I believe if you look closely, there is a hot tub on our roof. We do have a hot tub. And we also have wonderful breakfast that we serve to our guests every morning. It's sort of a cross between a Euro boutique hotel and an old-fashioned bed and breakfast.
Nice. And do you come from the bed and breakfast industry, or is this a new venture for you?
I'm actually a chef by trade. I'm from the East Coast. I'm from Massachusetts. Came out to your beautiful town 3 years ago and just decided that this was going to be my home.
There's a lot of that going around.
There is.
I haven't looked back, and I loved every minute of it.
So have you fantasized, dreamed about running a bed and breakfast? Is that something you always had in the back of your mind?
I think it was a natural progression for me, Larry. What happened was I owned a catering business and a restaurant and did it for many years, enjoyed it. I would cater large weddings for 300 people out in the middle of a field, and I just got a little tired of lugging things back and forth and figured that this wasn't going to be something I would do into my golden years. So the hospitality industry is in my blood. I love it. And it was a natural progression to just want to make breakfast for folks and have them feel comfortable and just have them have a wonderful experience here in Park City.
And I think, you know, there's bed and breakfasts all over the country, but I think there's something special about a bed and breakfast in a ski town, right? You go out skiing, it's a physical activity, you come back, you're a little tired. That's what we used to do when I was a young kid. We'd go on vacation to, it wasn't officially called a bed and breakfast, but essentially that's what it was. And it was just so fun because in the morning, you're getting ready for the ski day, you're chit-chatting with the owners. It just makes it a little extra special to be a bed and breakfast in a ski town.
I agree. In New England, we have a lot of smaller mountains that really can't accommodate a Marriott or a Hilton. Mm-hmm. So the bed and breakfast industry is up and thriving in Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire. I always correlate skiing with bed and breakfasts. And our guests come down in the morning. They read the ski report. They read the paper, have a wonderful carb-filled breakfast so they can get out there and have some energy. We have great ski services, so ski butlers will come in or one of our ski vendors will come in, outfit them with skis. They can go downstairs in their pajamas if they'd like and take care of that. And then right. They head out for a great day, come back for some après. We have every day is a little different. This afternoon we'll have chicken soup for après. Yesterday we had wine and cheese. We do cookies and hot chocolate, espresso. So there's always something going on. The fireplace is always on. There's always a hot, roaring fire to sit around and maybe play a game of Scrabble.
Right.
Well, talk a little bit about that gingerbread house because I go around the traffic circle every day. So I've seen the daily progress for quite some time. And I know you tore that house back to the bare studs.
Oh yes.
And then you and then you built additions onto that. So it has a totally different look, but it was like almost building the house from scratch. You just had a shell, really.
Absolutely. It was a 16-month project.
I was going to say I was too polite to say that it seemed to go on forever, and forever was 16 months. Huh?
16 months, exactly. And it was a labor of love. I fell in love with the views. I knew that the building was a fixer-upper and just really fell in love with the view from the roof, basically, the view of watching skiers come back from quitting time, looking out at night over the beautiful lights of Main Street. It was just a perfect location. However, not a perfect building. So we made the building commercial compliant. So we have fire suppression in there now. We have a 4-story elevator. It's completely ADA compliant. So for our guests who have special abilities, we're totally compliant.
And was that a requirement by the city or was that a business decision you made to make it ADA compliant?
It was both. It was both. I don't think that public buildings should exclude anyone. And we have a public building. So I definitely wanted to make it something where everyone could feel comfortable. So the elevator, and we have one room in specifically that's perfect for someone who is in a wheelchair. And the guests just, you know, can get around.
That's good for our audience to know because I think, you know, we have a lot of older historic buildings here that would be difficult for somebody with special needs. So it's good to know Torchlight, if you have somebody that does have special needs, the Torchlight should be on the short list of places to consider.
Please put me on your short list. Absolutely. It's just a very comfortable area. You don't have to get all dressed up to come down for breakfast. Right. And there's only a few B&Bs in town, and we're all a little different from each other. So I think we're offering a really nice selection of, you know, just the little down-home feeling like you had right. mentioned earlier.
Yeah. Right. Now, this is a business show, so talk a little bit about the business of running a B&B. Like, what's the range of rates? And when you only have six rooms, you don't have a lot of you probably need to have run a certain occupancy rate to pay the bills and turn a profit.
Yes, and there is a certain growth curve. Your first 1 or 2 years, you're expecting only to get into the 30% and 40% occupancy brackets. I'm hoping that by next year, we'll have repeat guests. We'll have word of mouth that helps in our favor. Our room rates begin at $250 a night, which is not exorbitant for downtown Park City. We're basically on the bus line. We're directly across the street from the bus terminal, from a wonderful free bus system that we have in town. And I believe that guests are going to find that the value of their stay, not having to go out and buy breakfast, not having to get on the mountain and then find something to eat, having their breakfast, having their après, all the little things that we do that the larger hotels sort of charge you for. We don't charge you for bottled water. We don't charge you for our little snacks that we leave in your room every day. It's just sort of something that we do.
You know, it's a good question, though, the business question, Larry, because I think the trend nationwide is there's fewer bed and breakfasts each year, because in most towns, it's tough to make a bed and breakfast work. And even in Park City, Linda and I, before we moved here, we stayed at a bed and breakfast called, I think it was called the Angel House.
There was the Angel House, the Imperial, there was the Miner's Rest, or I think it was called something like
Miner's
that.
Miner's Lodge.
Miner's Lodge. And I think I've seen more go than come,
right?
Which is why I asked the business question.
But, you know, I think the economic cycle has a lot to do with it as well. And I think the toughest days are behind us for the city. And one of the things I noticed that I think is going to help bed and breakfasts here locally is we're not just a ski town anymore. This town is busy. To me, it seems like we're busy 40 weeks out of the year. I like it when it's a little slow here and you can easily yeah. find a parking spot. And it seems like just in my short tenure here in 7 years, there's fewer and fewer weeks that are slow, which is good for the businesses, good for bed and breakfasts.
Absolutely. I you know, being a new person here, I understand that the shoulder seasons are getting shorter and shorter. Yep. I know that in the summertime, this was my first full summer here, and I was just absolutely floored at how gorgeous it was out here. We're right on a mountain bike trail. If you walk your mountain bike maybe 50 yards up the hill, you can get onto Lost Prospector Trail.
Sure.
So, and we're right in the middle of it all. So I agree that folks that are not coming here in the summer are really missing out, because it's absolutely gorgeous and there are no bugs or humidity.
That's true. Somebody that grew up in
Ohio, poison ivy.
You do notice that there's no bugs. Well, it's a big investment on your part. It's a leap of faith. The building is gorgeous. Congratulations on that.
We wish
you all the best. If folks want to find out more about the Torchlight Inn, can they stop by and visit? And is there a way to visit online as well?
Absolutely. We have a website, www.torchlightinn.com. And we normally have regular hours at the inn, but if you want to give us a call in advance, it's 1-855-EPIC-DAY, EPICDAY. Give us a call in advance and you can come by and tour the place.
Great. Well, congratulations on the opening and best wishes. I'm sure this next 2 weeks is going to be really busy with
Sundance. Absolutely. We're ready.
In that location. And Larry, my wife has a saying that we tell, you know, we all have people that want to stay here. And when they're coming, they're like, oh, Doug and Linda live there. Or Larry and Carol live nearby. Let's give them a call. And my wife has a phrase, we'd love to have you. Which 2 days would you like to stay with us? Most people are coming for longer than 2 days. So it's nice to have a good place that we can recommend.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Doug. We love having guests of of friends that are in town, and it's a perfect combination. And you can even come in and have breakfast with your guests. So
that's a good selling
point. That works.
All right. Chris Monroe, owner of Torchlight Inn, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you very much. Like, thank you, Larry.
Thank you for coming in, and it's good to see the open sign is on. Excellent.
And stay tuned to Mountain Money. Up next is going to be the newest director of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, Utah's very own Peter Metcalf. We also know him as the CEO of Black Diamond. Looking forward to that conversation. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned.
Park City Realty Group is proud to support KPCW. Park City Realty Group has provided real estate services to buyers and sellers since 2005. Our team shares local knowledge and insight with clients who value the Park City lifestyle. Knowledge plus hard work equals success. 649-1991 or parkcityrealtygroup.com.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. That was a fun conversation with Chris Monroe, the owner of the new bed and breakfast here in town called Torchlight Inn. On the phone with us now is Peter Metcalf. He's the CEO of Black Diamond. We have them periodically on KPCW. Black Diamond is one of the companies that makes living in Utah special. Always fun talking to Peter. Peter, welcome to Mountain Money.
Right, thanks so much. Nice to be here.
So, you know, today's conversation is going to be a little different than the ones we've had in the past. This is a nice appointment that you've gotten. You're the newest director of the Salt Lake branch of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. That's a 3-year term that just started, began a couple weeks ago. Congratulations on that appointment.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's I'm honored to be able to serve.
What do you think led the Board of Governors to your door to bring you into the fold?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I was candidly quite surprised when I received a phone call at the beginning of the summer of 2013 from Robin Rockwood, who heads up the Salt Lake City branch, and said she wanted to come talk to me about this. And my first response was, are you sure you have the right person?
Yeah, you're an old climbing bum.
Exactly. It's like, and so what it really, the reason for it, as she explained it to me, was that the business leader who I'm replacing, Scott Hymus, who is the CEO of R.C. Willey, he was fulfilling a place on the board that really is allocated to someone in the world of consumer products. And so what they're trying to do with the makeup or the composition of the directors of most of the banks is to have a broad spectrum of business people, as well as bankers, depending on who's appointed you, to help the Fed develop its monetary policy. So here in Salt Lake, we have a representative of agriculture from Idaho. We have high tech. We have mining, CFO of Kennecott, and we have banking. And we have manufacturing with Futura Industries. So what they're trying to do is again, they want somebody representing what they feel are the primary categories that help make up the Utah economy, to give insight into what are the trends, what are we seeing on the supply side, how is demand, what does the global marketplace look like for our products, that sort of thing. And why me over someone else? You'd have to talk to people at the Fed as to why, but I think from talking with them, part of it was just the global nature now of Black Diamond's business, the fact that we have become a reasonably respected and high-profile business here in the Intermountain West, and I think that with that as well has come also an opportunity for me to be a little bit more involved at the public policy level with both government officials and other business leaders. I think it was that combination of factors that brought them to the decision to offer me the appointment.
So people that are mad at Ben Bernanke for starting the taper, they shouldn't blame you, right? That wasn't your recommendation.
I'm brand new.
I'm kidding. You know, the Federal Reserve plays a really important role, and I think since the credit crisis 2008, 2009, people have seen just how important that role is. And everybody differs in their view on how the Fed has handled that. I think they've done a great job overall. They haven't been perfect, but I think they got the macro part of that right. And I think one of the challenges for the Fed is they do have access to so much data. And I think what's missing from that data is insights that folks like yourself, Peter, can bring to the table and say, okay, let's forget about the data. Here's what I'm seeing. Here's what I'm feeling. Here's what the other CEOs that I'm interacting with, here's how we're feeling. Because that, how does the CEO feel does impact things, right? How quickly you hire, how quickly you expand. That's an important piece to it, and I'm glad to see that the Fed has those voices available to them.
Doug, you've just hit the nail on the head. I spent 2 days in San Francisco last week for, quote, my training and the board meeting of the San Francisco board of the Federal Reserve. And in the training, speaking to the new directors, that's exactly what John, who's the head of the San Francisco office, was saying, that they have ungodly amounts of data that they analyze, they crunch, et cetera. But what they're really seeking is exactly what you said, the insights, feelings, visceral sort of takes that the CEOs have from the businesses that they're running, from the marketplace that they're in, from the people that they're dealing with. And that is really incredibly helpful for them as they develop their monetary policy. And in participating here in what was my first meeting, and I did get to sit in on the last meeting of the Salt Lake City Fed in December, that's exactly what goes on, is the CEOs and CFOs sharing their insights as to what they're seeing. And, you know, in a business like Black Diamond, we really do get a great sense of what's coming in the way of price increases or slack demand in factories in Asia, changes in demand in Europe. Does demand equate with high unemployment, or is there something else going on where in Europe you might have high unemployment but you're not seeing a slack off of demand? You just see a lot when you're running a business, both what's coming in the next 12 to 24 months and what's going on a global basis. And that is exactly what they are seeking to get illuminated. And they really listen. And I should add one more thing, which is just having spent the 2 days now in San Francisco, I came away so incredibly impressed with this independent institution called the Federal Reserve, the level of professionalism, the leadership, the intelligence and energy of the people there. I mean, they are absolutely mission-driven. They know what they did during the last financial crisis we had. They're very proud of it, and they are, you know, complete professionals. Incredibly impressive group of people to be associated.
So, Peter, let's talk a little bit about the insights you can provide. What are you seeing now in your business and in talking to other manufacturers and consumer goods executives? Better days certainly are ahead. What are you, if someone asked for the executive summary of business today in your sector, what would you say?
You know, it would be better to answer that on a segment-by-segment basis is how we think about our business. But to answer it as a general term, we are guardedly optimistic about 2014 from the perspective of increasing demand on a global basis. And that is a direct result of a combination of issues. One, the Chinese working through some of the challenges that they had at the beginning of 2013, and they seem to have come through that, and demand is picking up there again. The fact that other parts of Asia seem very stable. The fact that Europe has successfully gotten through what I would call a crisis of confidence in the euro. Remember, a year ago at this time, we were all talking about, would the euro survive? And many people, not at the extreme ends, questioned whether the euro really would survive as we knew it, as we know it. And so between that and a slight modicum of growth returning to Europe and the fact that you have a very solid safety net in Europe, a social safety net that we don't have here in the U.S., means that purchasing is continuing, especially for outdoor recreation where it doesn't cost a lot to do these sorts of things. And then on the inflation side of things, side of the equation, we just don't see much sign of inflation. The level of competition is huge. There was additional capacity on a manufacturing side put in during the last period of rapid growth in our industry, which ended about 15 months ago. That is still there, and though there is inflation, wage rates in Asia, especially China right now, very few people are willing to pass on the price increases and are just working to get more efficient simply because there is slack in the system. And then you combine that with the fact that the Internet has given the consumer an incredible tool by which to search for the lower price. It really is like Adam Smith's invisible hand bringing the most efficient, bringing together in the most efficient manner buyers and sellers, which puts a lot of power in the hands of the consumer. And as a result of all this, we see very little ability of anyone to be raising prices. And we see relatively little inflation in the system, and we see the economies in the world picking up modestly and just being more stable. And with stability comes the confidence by consumers to spend a bit more because they're not worried about, quote, the world ending tomorrow or currency collapsing,
Peter,
or wondering about the value of their savings.
Peter, I want to take you back to your point on inflation and then a previous comment. So thank goodness inflation has been low. I think that that has given power also to the Federal Reserve to do some of the things they've needed to do to help try to stimulate job growth. But I think your comment on being guardedly optimistic, I hear that a lot from CEOs. What would it take, and we've only got a minute for this answer, and sorry, there's not much time. What would it take for your view to go from guardedly optimistic to optimistic? What's missing?
A higher level of demand in the global marketplace. We've just come through a period where beginning in part, we are weather dependent in part, and we had a very mediocre winter last winter. We had floods in Europe, if you remember the spring, and it really put a damper on a lot of parts of the outdoor industry, the bike industry and other industries. So it demand was tepid. And if that demand starts coming back, which it really felt like it's starting to come back, and stayed stable, that combined with continued growing participation numbers around the world, I think that would shift us from guardedly optimistic to optimistic.
Okay. Well, thanks, Peter, for joining us. Park City resident Peter Metcalf, CEO of Black Diamond, and now a director of the Salt Lake branch of the Federal Reserve. Congratulations. Thanks for joining us.
Larry, thank you, and Doug, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Peter, always fun having you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, and we'll be back to wrap Mountain Money after this.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to Mountain Money in the final minutes. I want to thank our great sponsors for Mountain Money, the Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Iron Mountain Group, Park City Chamber, Prudential Real Estate, and San Francisco Design. We thank you one and all for underwriting this program, and a good lineup today.
It was a good lineup, and I just am grateful to everybody. And, you know, the nice thing about having Paul Oyer on, the economist, is we've only had two economists on the show, Paul and then also, Larry, I don't know if you remember, Scott Schaefer.
Sure.
From the University of Utah. Both of them have been able to put economics in everyday terms, which I think makes for a great conversation.
Indeed. And we followed him up with Chris Monroe, who's opened the Torchlight Parade in the last month. And did I say Torchlight Parade? Torchlight Inn. The Torchlight Inn. And
I think it was Donna Mackler that led the Torchlight Parade at Deer Valley this year.
But that's what I was thinking about. And Peter Metcalf, of course. And I want to remind you that tomorrow, Chris and Nell on This Green Earth will first talk with a representative from the Department of Wildlife resources about the bald eagle deaths. We've had several dozen of them in the northern part of the state. Now they think they know what's going on. And then they'll talk about that chemical spill that's making news in West Virginia. And they're kind of curious about why West Virginia hadn't inspected that site since 1991. So they'll be talking about that on This Green Earth next week. And did you get to the freestyle this weekend?
You know, my wife had a big birthday this weekend, so we were busy celebrating that. So we missed it this year. Most years we do get there. But I hear it was phenomenal. There were, 8,000 people there on Saturday?
8,000 for aerials. It was just spectacular. And congratulations to Deer Valley. I want to remind you that this coming weekend, NBC on their sports channel, NBCSP, will have a replay of that. Well, that's Mountain Money. Thanks for joining us. This is KPCW Park City.